Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Stand by for Operation Wilson Exercise. Stand by for Operation Wilson Exercise.
This is the Toffee Web Podcast.
Hello, Blues. This is the Toffee Web Podcast coming to you on the eve of what is expected to be a very quiet transfer deadline day and in the wake of the FA Cup defeat to Luton and the 0-0 draw at Fulham, a result that unfortunately saw Everton drop back into the relegation zone. In the absence of any luck on the injury front and the fact that the club barely has two pennies to rub together to try and plug some glaring holes in the team before the window closes, a lot of the focus, indeed a lot of the hope now, is on Everton's appeal against the 10-point deduction, which got underway today, Wednesday, and will reportedly wrap up on Friday. I'm Lyndon Lloyd. Paul Traill is with me. Adam McCulloch returns for his first appearance of the year, and we're delighted to have Evertonian and author Jim Keoghan joining us to try and pick some optimism out of the bones of despair. But failing that, his new book, Everything He Wanted to Know About Everton, But We're Afraid to Ask, which came out in November, provides a light-hearted diversion. We'll chat about that later in the show, but for now, Jim, a warm welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll let you kick things off. What were your feelings after the final whistle at Craven Cottage? I think what happened at Kenilworth Road, coming on the heels of obviously that cup defeat at Goodison when Luton beat us for the second time this season, obviously colours things a little, but based on your expectations going in, a good point earned or 2 points dropped?
Well, I think when you saw the sides before kickoff, and you know how many issues we've got, I think you'd have gone there and thought that a point was okay, really. And it was a weird game because it was quite back and forth. I think either team could have won it. To be honest, I mean they had some really good chances, didn't they? And Pickford's save was incredible in the second half. But I think kind of what haunts you is that miss at the end because you know it's the last 2-3 minutes. And you have effectively an open goal, and we could have really kind of stolen 3 points there. And you wonder how he misses that. And it's kind of it worries me because it seems to be symptomatic of a bigger problem that if you don't have forwards, you can score goals at all. Then how do you navigate the next 4 months? And there seems to be a real problem at Everton at the moment with the front line, and it's encapsulated in that miss. So it's you know, it's still a point, which is, you know, you can't, you know, it could end up being vital at the very end, but it did feel like we could have easily got all three. And then it's a very different picture this morning. Then you're not in the bottom three, and it's, you know, you go into these two very tough fixtures coming up, feeling slightly better. But it's, so, you know, I guess psychologically, to go into these games now in the bottom three is an issue. So it's it's a point in the road, which is good, but it could have been a lot better.
Yeah, see it the same way, Paul.
Yeah, I guess so. It's a really, really frustrating miss at the end, isn't it? The header. I sympathised a little bit with the scramble. It was one of them another day, but it might have bobbled in, you know. But the header, he's really got to put that in, hasn't he? The Beto there. I'm most annoyed about the penalty. I can't get over the penalty that we didn't get. I've been trying so hard not to sort of go along this conspiracy path of but the longer this goes on, you do begin to wonder, don't you? Like the iffy decisions going against us and everything that's happening. I just couldn't fathom. I was just so angry that we didn't get that penalty there. That was the big one for me, because that could have really changed games. We've seen how good we tend to be at holding on to a lead early once we go one up. Yeah, and that was, and we held them out as it was anyway, you know. So that was really frustrating. But then, despite all that, yeah, we could easily snatch it at the end there. I'm more frustrated than anything else, I think. I think it's a good point gain. You'd have taken it before the game with the team out on the pitch. But it just feels like it could have been one of them which we should have won, really. You could even argue on chances. I mean, they had some good chances second half, but we had plenty of good chances ourselves. And away from home, you get that. And we never seem to be able to be that team who can just win when you're not at your best, when you're not the better team. Plenty of teams seem to do that against us. Nick will win here and there when we've played quite well and beat us, you know, but we just never seem to do it. And while we're keeping good clean sheets, as Jim just said, if you're not scoring any goals, then it's become a real problem now. Beto can't put them away. It's 16 goals, 16 games without a goal for Dominic. You know, and you look around the team and there's not too many who can really chip in with goals, are there really? You know what I mean? If those two don't. So we've got to figure that out. I feel, you know, you keep creating them opportunities, goals will come. I do feel that Dominic, it's not like, for me anyway, it's not like a Mope situation where like you just never felt he could really score last season, despite all the gains. You feel that, I feel anyway, that Dominic, and he's proven it before, that he will click into game, and then hopefully once he does, he gets a few goals, then things get a little bit better for everybody. He's a little bit unlucky not to score last night. For the header he was stretching for a bit, which hit the bar, he might have scored. I thought the diving head was a really good effort, which was unlucky to loop onto the top. So, you know, he's still confident. He's still getting into that position. So I think I want something to go in for him, and then hopefully it triggers a bit more. But I think really we need them big players back, don't we? And particularly the core, Jesse Gaze on the way back will help. And Arno obviously should be back soon. Good to see Young back. So hopefully a few weeks' time, that, you know, bit more of a squad in place, and hopefully I'm confident we'll be okay, but we really need to start converting chances into goals.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell, isn't it? I mean, we thought that bringing in competition for Dominic would sort of ease that worry, you know, our impotence up front, and then it doesn't really solve the problem, does it? Because you saw two sides who, like Bev said, both sides create great chances, both sides hit the woodwork. Fulham kept getting into really good positions and looked like they needed a front man. We had a front man, but didn't really feed him enough in terms of Dominic. And then Beto comes on the pitch and you think he gets that chance. He gets that one gilt-edged chance. Dominic's two headers, as you said, Paul, particularly the second one was tough. And if you wanted anyone on the end of it, you think, great, we've got our £25 million man from Serie A on the end of it. He's just going to put this away. I could put it away. And very, very frustrating. I think as you both alluded to as well, before the game, do you take a point away at Fulham? Yeah. Do you take it with Godfrey at right back and Ashley Young on right wing? Yeah, you definitely do. But do you take it after you've sort of ridden your luck at both ends of a pitch and created two really gilt-edged opportunities in the last minute? That's a sickener. And obviously with the wider issues, as you mentioned in the build-up, Lyndon, it would have been nice this week to have had something to really cheer about. So what was a solid performance at times, it certainly takes that edge off it away from home. And we're going to have to talk about the handball decision or lack thereof. Yeah, I'm with you, Paul. The Tin Hat Brigade, which there aren't too many of. I know Elle started that conspiracy rabbit hole some time ago. I wouldn't say I'm a believer yet, but I'm definitely getting close to it, because it's starting to feel like a bit of a sick and twisted joke. I think the only thing that would have made last night feel even more perfect was if Fulham had got a penalty for a handball decision down the other end after Beto's miss. That would have really kind of wrapped it up in a neat little bow. But I do not understand what the officials, and obviously the officials at Stockley Park, haven't seen in that moment to not award a penalty. And obviously, as we all know, and as we've all ruminated to death, it's when you look at it in contrast to other decisions that have gone against us. So that's incredibly frustrating. I must admit at this point, and whether it's just because I'm a bit tired or I'm just a bit tired of football, but I don't necessarily have that anger anymore, because it is almost expected. And that is, I guess, where you do fill that vacuum with a little bit of conspiracy. I kind of get it at this point, because it's such an obvious error. And surely those kinds of decisions are usually the ones that you think, oh, well, kind of VAR's there to eliminate that. VAR's there to remove those kinds of bizarre handball decisions that tend to be the real game changers. You know, there's no hand of God. There's no Thierry Henry against Ireland. I'm not putting that decision against Anthony Robinson in the same breath, but it was a handball on the line in a game of Premier League football. I don't really understand how it's not been caught. But it wasn't, and we move on. And as you say, Jim, it would have been nice to go into a tough run of games after a spate of injuries and some bad luck to have gone into that with 3 points. But a point on the board, fine, we'll take it.
We've talked about the refereeing a lot on the pod. Jim, where are you? Are you conspiracy or incompetence? Where do you come down on this?
Well, you always think if it's incompetence, it'd be random, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But it seems to be very focused on us. I mean, it's awful that it makes you think like this, really. Because, I mean, you know, you kind of fundamentally think there can't be a conspiracy. It can't be. Yeah. It has to just be incompetent officials. And yet, when you look at kind of the stats, you look at how long it's been since we've had a penalty, how rarely people get sent off against Everton as well. We seem to be an outlier at the moment in terms of kind of the stats. So it's, you know, if you're being kind, maybe you say there's something weird going on. I'm not sure what it is, whether it's kind of, you know, unconscious bias or something like that. But there's it's definitely odd. And yet, and you look at last night, and it is really difficult to understand when a player, you know, puts his arm out and the ball hits it. So his arm is in an unnatural position. It's in the box, and it's not even looked at. And you're thinking, you know. Again, part of you thinks if that was the other end and that exact same thing happened, it probably would be a penalty for Fulham. And it's, I think with all the kind of, as Dyche calls it, the noise elsewhere at the moment, it's kind of feeding into that. We do feel kind of persecuted against. And you know, the longer this goes on, the weirder it gets. You're kind of thinking, what would it take for Everton to get a penalty this season? Really? Would like a player need to be strangled in the box? Would the player need to catch the ball completely? You know, we've had so many instances where people have been, like, you know, two-footed, tripped, handballs, pushed, and that doesn't get given. So, kind of, what is the bar for an Everton penalty? Because it seems to be very different to other teams. You get them, you know, the teams you get more in one game than we get in 18 months. So it's, you know, and you know, people often say, oh, you know, the big teams get more pens because they attack more. Well, Everton are a very attacking team. We are creating loads of chances. We are in the opposition box quite a lot. You know, so why aren't we getting the same levels of penalties as other people, especially when you can point to this season alone maybe 5 or 6 examples of kind of challenges or issues where it would be a penalty for a different team, and they have been given for other teams for similar things. So it's yeah, I don't necessarily have like a tinfoil hat on, but the longer it goes on, it's getting weird, and you do wonder, will we get a penalty this season? Or maybe just get thrown one at, like, when we're 3-0 down, it's the 91st minute, something like that.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. you know, that's what you can say. That the throw was a bonus, so we shut up. But it's, yeah, I don't think there's a conspiracy going on, but it's, you can really appreciate why people do.
Thing for me with that as well, though, it's like when people, I think you said it on our WhatsApp thread, Lyndon, and you just kind of mentioned that Adam was like, oh, stop getting angry about it now. I'm kind of so used to it. Like, I'm getting angry about it because it's becoming stark for me how critical this could be. Now we're in the bottom three. If we don't get our points back, and yeah, like, God, there was a big song and dance about Wolves getting all the decisions against them. I bet they've had penalties. Well, they have had penalties because we're the only team who haven't. I bet they've played against 10 men. You know what I mean? Like, you know, are any teams more hard done to than we are actually now? But there's no big song and dance about it. You know what I mean? No one seems to really, the media don't really sort of like to draw any attention towards it as far as I can tell. So, I'm actually getting really angry about it now because I think it's starting to worry me, and that, like, you know, if things don't start leveling out at some point, then it could really, really be a crucial factor in us staying in the league if we don't get any points back, say, or don't get many points back. So, yeah, that's the biggest worry for me of all this, is that it could really affect us. You know what I mean? Because we're not scoring any goals. Well, you know, maybe if we get that penalty in the first half and Calvert-Lewin bang, you know, scores it and we go one up, and then maybe he's buzzing a bit more, then maybe we can score more goals. If you're not getting anything like that, you know what I mean? You need them contributors. And then, and there's the other one as well with Jack Harrison. Like, you think, like, okay, yeah, maybe I wouldn't be, you know, I wasn't screaming my head off for the penalty for that. But then when you see, like, the Jota one or the, you know, the Luiz one, you know what I mean, both in the same game, which are, like, you know, like, far less contact if you're looking at it that way, you know. So, yeah, it is worrying me a bit now. And I hope it starts turning around quickly and we start getting a fair crack, because it doesn't feel fair at the moment.
Yeah, I come down on the unconscious bias because, like you, Jim, I can't fathom that there would be a conspiracy against, you know, either a single club or a group of clubs. But I've always believed there's an unconscious bias. I mean, it stands to reason that, you know, the bigger teams with the more vocal managers, be it, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson or Jurgen Klopp or the like, you know, it's just, and all the focus that goes on it from Sky and that focus on the big six in quotes and all that, it just stands to reason that there would be. And if you look at some of the penalties that Sadio Mane used to get for Liverpool, that Salah used to get for just flopping on the floor, when you put those up against some of the ones that we haven't got this season, it's mind-boggling. It is absolutely mind-boggling that there is such a discrepancy. But again, I mean, it's a mixture of incompetence and that just unconscious bias. I mean, I do wonder if yesterday they rushed through the decision, because there is, if you look at it from the side on camera angle, his arm is by his side. But if you look at it, obviously from behind the other goal, it's clearly way out, you know, way out from his body. So, I mean, if that's the case, if they have rushed it and not looked at all the camera angles, then that's just another damning indictment of the whole situation. But yeah, I think, Paul, you're right. It's one of those things where we get that penalty. We need a break. Clearly, in front of goal, we need something to go for us, and hopefully that will be a spark. And it's, you know, and for other teams, a penalty can be that, you know, because clearly we're having problems scoring goals ourselves. You know, Calvert-Lewin's goal drought is a worry, but you can't imagine that it can go on for much longer. Beto's going to need some time and patience. I'm trying to be as patient as I can with him, but you know, without sort of conjuring memories of the sweet Prince Omar Nias, you know, it's becoming a concern. But again, he's sort of an agent of chaos. I don't even think that he knows what he's doing. And so, from that perspective, it's again, something will hopefully sort of bounce off someone's backside, and we can get a run of things going up some points on the board. But last night obviously marked the first anniversary of Sean Dyche's appointment as Everton manager. Jim, how do you assess the job he's done so far as a whole? What are your feelings about him as we currently stand out of both cups in pretty disappointing fashion, really, and with just one win in the last nine in all competitions?
I rate him. I think he's done a good job. I mean, no, he's not perfect. Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes his subs are frustrating, and the way his inflexibility at times is frustrating. But actually, when you bear in mind kind of what he walked into and what's gone on around the club over the past year, and kind of, you know, his inability to really, you know, go into the transfer market and create the team necessary that he wants. I mean, you know, if the 10 points were added, we'd now be a mid-table team, and you may maybe be talking about a kind of a late European push. If he'd been able to spend as well, I'm sure we'd be in a better position. So under, like, I think incredibly testing circumstances, he's done a decent job. I mean, it's not perfect, but, you know, how many managers are perfect? It's rare to get kind of, you know, the ideal manager. I think for where we are right now, he really suits us. I think he understands the fight. He seems to have put down a blueprint of how Everton are going to play under him and how they're going to navigate this difficult time. The players we've got at the moment seem to suit what Dyche wants to do. I mean, there are certain issues. Yet we haven't got like a backup to Corey, which is a problem because he seems to rely on that quite a lot. He's got us defensively sound. You know, we've got more clean sheets this season than you know, we've had for a long time. You know, there's loads of good things going on. And I said again, he's, you know, under, you know, horrendous circumstances. I, you know, when you think of our recent managers that we have had, I'm sure they would have buckled under this. I mean, he seems unfazed. He comes out in press conferences. He talks a good game. You know, he talks about alignment a lot, doesn't he? And that seems to be a big thing. But there is signs of that. You know, the fans are kind of, you know, bought into what he wants to do. So it's, I'd say probably like an 8 out of 10 at the moment. I think he's the right man for the job right now. Whether he will be in the long term, I don't know. I mean, God knows where Everton will be in 2-3 years' time. But at the moment, he seems to be the right man for the job. And I think he's done a decent job as well.
Yeah, Paul, that was actually going to be this week's question to rate Dyche's performance out of 10. So why don't you tack your rating on to the end of your comments about the gaffer?
I don't need to. Jem just said, I think, pretty much everything there was. I would have thought, yeah. Really. No, I agree. 8 out of 10. I think, like, you know what? If things a bit more rub here and this season, you'd probably be looking at more like a 9 out of 10 if you didn't have the 10-point deduction save. Even with that, some of the other results, I mean, like, you could say 6 points. We could have had an extra 6 points just from the two Fulham games. We certainly should have had a goal in the first one and a penalty in the other one, both when it was 0-0. You know what I mean? So then some of the other games as well. You got Wolves at home, Sheffield United away to an extent. Again, another one we should have had a penalty in when it was a draw. Spurs away. I mean, a lot's gone against us. You know what I mean? And that's not even talking about, like, lack of capability of really transfers, what he's had to do, what he's had to deal with ball doing upheaval, what happened with Belkemley. There's a heck of a lot's gone on at the club. There always is a heck of a lot going on at the club, but it feels like it's been, you know, really sort of magnified under Sean Dyche. And I think one important thing for me is how well does your manager represent Everton Football Club? And I always thought Moyes represented us quite well, very well, actually. I loved how Carlo Ancelotti represented us. Marcus Silva never represented us that well. I couldn't stand how Rafa Benitez represented us. Mm-hmm. Lampard, okay, you know what I mean? But I think he represents us well, and I think he sticks up for us well. And that's what I like. And, you know, I find if you're watching the press conferences on a, you know, on a Thursday afternoon, and you should be working or whatnot, and you know, if I'm not turning it off, like I always was in the Rafa Benitez, just a frustration of how he's acting and behaving and that, like, then that's half the battle for me if I'm on side with the manager. So, like, I like the guy. I like how he looks after us. The players seem to like him. They're buying into what he's trying to do. He's up for the fight. So, yeah, definitely 8 out of 10. And he's unlucky not to have done better this season. Unlucky not to have been in the semi-final of the cup as well, and the Onana penalty, you know what I mean? So, and who knows, might have got to a final, you never know. So really top marks for me.
Top marks, but 8 out of 10, I think. I'm just reiterating what you guys have said, which is always a sign of a good podcast. But I think he's probably the first manager in this Majeri era to, as you mentioned, Jim, to have his hands tied behind his back in some ways. The others have either had lots of money to spend, or in the case of Benitez, inherited sides who've had lots of money spent on them. He's the first one to kind of deal with austerity era Everton. And not only that, he's had to deal with a huge amount of noise off the pitch, an unprecedented points deduction. He's handled that situation incredibly well, as you said, Paul, in that public-facing role. He's had to be the de facto spokesperson during historic times, and he's done so, and he's only just celebrated a year. Celebrated, I don't know if he has celebrated a year in the role, but he's done a year of hard time, really. you know, it's probably taken some years off him, but I think he's, yes, frustrated at times, as the players kind of do. I really admire the squad that we've got at the moment, but I can also equally admonish them a lot. Like, there are times when I wish we'd play a bit more fluidly, or that we'd have a little bit more of the ball. But then I also see a passion and a grit there that's been lacking under other managers. And we do create lots of chances, even if we're not scoring at the moment. We are in and around the box. We're not passive as we were under Lampard, or incredibly defensive as we were under the likes of Benitez and Allardyce. So there's a lot to like there. I guess without the points deduction and without all the uncertainty off the pitch, where we spend most of our time worrying about transfer decisions from 3 years ago rather than who's starting at right back, then you would be saying to yourself, what a great job, how far can he go? But also, is he the one to take us further? Is he the one to lead us out to a new stadium? But those would be the more long-term questions that you'd maybe say, there's a bit of a question mark there. Where's the ceiling with Deitch? But the fact is, we don't know that, because there's so much to deal with in the here and now. And he's doing so under immense pressure. So I think an 8 out of 10 is fair for someone who's performed well, who, yes, is a bit annoying with some of his in-game decisions and his lack of flexibility slash Ashley Young approval on a regular basis. But there's a lot to like there as well. So, and I think he's the right man for right now.
Yeah. I mean, I find myself wrestling with the question of how much we should expect of him in terms of how we're playing, you know, the lack of what I see as tactical flexibility and variety in our play. I mean, you know, at times we're pretty dire, the football, but, you know, given what he's been up against, what, you know, all three of you said in terms of the financial constraints and injuries and refereeing injustice and all the noise in quotes of what's going on off the pitch. I mean, it's hard to argue against what he's done, particularly when you stack it up against, you know, Lampard. We are measurably better in almost all departments than we were under Lampard. So from that perspective alone, and given what he has to achieve, which is basically just to keep us up, just get us into the new stadium and still in the Premier League, you know, points deductions notwithstanding, then I think that, from that perspective, maybe an 8 out of 10. But for me, just the struggles that I'm having with how we're playing, and the fact that even with those personnel constraints, even when we've got more of a greater complement of players, I still feel like we're lacking when it comes to just playing football. So that for me, I think I'd probably give him a 7. But you know, you can't argue with the fact that he's kept us up one season, and on course, I think over the balance of the season, if you extrapolate out the points so far, without the points deduction, then we're comfortably safe. And I think then we just have to keep our fingers crossed that we can sort of keep on an even keel until towards the end of the season. We've got a favourable run of games, I think, where there are some points to be had, and we need to get past Spurs, get past Man City, and then maybe sort of reassess, hopefully have some of those players back, and then just sort of focus on picking up enough points to either stay above Luton, stay above Forest, whatever happens with their points deduction. You know, Palace are struggling. Obviously, next season we can worry about playing style and all that kind of thing. So that's kind of where I am with it. Let's look ahead to the Spurs game, lunchtime kickoff on Saturday. This one's going to be really hard to predict without knowing who's going to be available. You know, again, we've got so many players out. It's not clear at this point if Idrissa Gueye is going to be back in time. It's possible we could without him. Amadou Onana, Andre Gomes, Seamus Coleman, and now Arnaud Danjuma, who doesn't look like he's going to be kicking the ball for a couple of weeks at least, depending on what he's done to his ankle. So, I mean, we're going to struggle to field a side soon. But Jim, what are your expectations of this one? Spurs will obviously be coming off a midweek game and shorter rest, but they have a lot more depth than us, so it's just going to be tough all around, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's Spurs, isn't it? It's always going to be a hard game. And as you said, I mean, a lot depends upon who's on the pitch. That's the issue. I think, a relatively full-strength Everton side at home could, you know, bear in mind how we played away when we finally kind of, you know, began playing after like 20 minutes. We could give Spurs a decent game, but it's, as you said, we're getting to the point now where are we going to have 11 kind of recognisable first-team players on the pitch at the moment? It's, I don't know. It's a really difficult one to call because you don't know what Everton side is going to be, really. I imagine if Dyche is short of players, then it's going to be kind of a more defensive performance and just try and maybe nullify Spurs and try and, you know, do them on a corner or something like that. I don't think it's going to be a, you know, free-flowing expression of football from us. I think it's realistically, we're going to be short of numbers and it'll be kind of a dig-in performance. But it's, I think we can get a point. I don't think, you know, Spurs are good. They aren't that good. And, you know, Dyche seem to know how to kind of navigate games quite well. So it's, it's difficult to call, but us getting a draw, it wouldn't be an enormous surprise. I don't think we'll win. I don't think we're in that place, but I think we definitely get a point.
Tough one to call, but I think he's got a good knack of knowing how to fess up against Tottenham. I found he seemed to do it well last season when we snatched a draw and we were sort of really like aggressively pressing, and certainly away at Tottenham. It was really unfair that we didn't get something from that game. I quite fancy us, you know. We're due a win, we're due some goals, we're due something to go in, you know what I mean? Maybe I keep saying it to myself at least, it's Dominic's day, you know, he's gonna pull it away. It's gonna happen sooner or later. Someone's gotta go for us, you know what I mean? So like Jack Havison, McNeil plays at that, might Garner, some of that might just chip in. It takes something like that, you know. I don't see why we can't. I mean, again, we don't know who's going to be, you know, who's going to be available. There's a few players limping around at the end of the game, wasn't there? Jabba Brantley was. I hope that's not going to be serious. You know, like there was a few players who nursing a few injuries. I like to think we can sort of at home have a bit of a go at them there, and we've seen at Tottenham you can get at them. You know, like if they get into a little bit. They get a bit panicky when it's not going the way I find Tottenham. And, I've just got a feeling we can sort of get into them. I hope Onana's fit. I hope that he just needed a bit of rest and another body in midfield. I somehow don't think, although he's fit probably, he came on in the African Nations Cup. I was watching a bit of the other day. I don't know, I just get the feeling that Trezeguet won't play or won't start at least. You know what Sean Dyche is like, and sort of, you know, holding players back a little bit more until they're fully ready. I just got an inkling about that one. I think we're due a win, whether we deserve it or not. We're due a win at some point soon. We're due a bit of luck somewhere. So yeah, maybe it's the game.
I hope so. Yeah, I think. Yeah, you look at the numbers. It's funny you say that Dyche wants everyone to be fully fit, but Ashley Young at 60% nailed on starter. I'm probably starts again at the weekend. You would imagine if one of Onana or Garner Gay is available, then that shifts McNeil out wide again, and we probably go with a very similar looking side to what we saw at Craven Cottage. I think if they're not, then it starts to look like maybe a kind of five at the back situation, because the options in the middle look limited, and losing Danjuma out there as well. I can't really see him starting Lewis Dobbin in a game like this. And obviously other options on the bench are pretty sparse, to be honest. It's back to the two goalies scenario, isn't it, really? So might be three soon. So
might be three, yeah.
who knows? But I think, is it a game I expect us to get something out of? a draw, I think, would be a really, really good result under the circumstances. At the time of recording, Spurs are actually 1-0 down at half-time to a goal from the much maligned Neil Mopé.
Of course.
Yeah, if he can do it, maybe Beto can. I did wonder if maybe the deferred payment scenario for Beto has gone against us. Maybe he's kind of deferring his composure until the first wad of money comes through. But I think, yeah, surely from a set piece or from some moment of spectacular luck, we'll get something, because we are, if you're absolutely right, by the way, Lyndon, in terms of the quality of football at times against Fulham and over certain portions of the season has been pretty turgid and pretty awful. And the way we play the ball out at times can be incredibly frustrating. But we do create chances. So if I'm sort of skewing towards optimistic, a la Paul, I'd say we will score eventually. And hopefully that is someone like Dom, just to get that confidence again. But I think a point against Spurs in this position would be a really good one. But hey, I'd take more.
That's what we all. Yeah, I think a draw would be a good result. You know, clearly, particularly if we can barely cobble together a team worthy of the name. I'm hoping, you would think that, you know, Idrissa Gueye would, I don't know whether his travel plans are set, but you'd think he'd be busting the gut to get back, just particularly if Onana's going to be missing, because, you know, obviously, if you have him in midfield, then obviously McNeil can go back out wide and cover for Danjoon. But otherwise, I don't know who fills that role. I mean, I've sort of reserving judgment on Lewis Dobbin as well. I think he's looked very raw, you know, as a potential starter. But we're getting to that situation, to that point now, where we're going to have to, you know, use some of these kids, or as few kids as we have available. But yeah, I mean, I think, Paul, your point about how we've kind of got needled Spurs a bit and sort of got under their skin a bit, I think that's what kind of fills me with a bit of confidence, is that they like to play out from the back, but they also make mistakes. So if we can kind of, you know, get something from that, force a mistake, get an early goal, then all of a sudden we've got something to protect. And yeah.
You're listening to the Toffee Web Podcast.
Well, let's talk about Jim's book, which again is called Everything You Want to Know About Everton, But We're Afraid to Ask. It's his fourth book on the Toffees after Highs, Lows and Bakayokos, which was about the mostly gloomy 1990s. Everton Greatest Games, Everton number 9. It's out now. You can buy it on Amazon. Before we get into the book itself, Jim, tell us your Everton origin story on the one hand and how you got into writing books on the other.
How I became an Evertonian? Through a threat, essentially, that I come from a family of blues, but my granddad was a red, and he was pushing me towards Liverpool when I was like 4 or 5. So me ma said that that Father Christmas doesn't visit Liverpool fans, only Evertonians. So I was like terrified into kind of, you know, nailing my colours to the mast. And then luckily, you know, my early Evertonian kind of experiences with kind of the mid 80s. So when I was first going the match, I just thought Everton, I not only had made the right choice and got, you know, presents at Christmas, I'd also chosen the right club. Everton were like sensation. I thought this is what it's going to be like forever, you know, winning leagues, getting to European finals, winning FA Cups. Obviously that was the blip, and the reality was, you know, decades of shit. But it's that's why I became an Evertonian. In terms of kind of writing about them, I mean, I've been writing for like 20 years on all kinds of stuff, and I've done a few football books. I've done one on supporter ownership, club punk football, and I've done one, How to Run a Football Club, which was a journey from the very bottom of the pyramid right to the top, and every level kind of state of the game journey, where you look at kind of what's going on. But, you know, you always want to write about something that you love, and so I kind of moved into Everton first with Highs and Lows to explore a very weird decade in the club's history. I think the 90s is a very strange time. It's that kind of transition period from us being an elite club to being modern Everton, you know, and sprinkled with some incredible moments, you know, like our last cup, two near-death experiences, the emergence of, I think, a different kind of Evertonian as well, kind of a more kind of buoy, angry, frustrated sort of blue that wasn't there in the 80s, wasn't there in the 70s. It's a very kind of new thing. And then from there, I just kind of kept writing. And so I did one on Everton. I did Everton number nine, looks at nine number nines. And I did Greatest Games, which, as the title suggests, looks at our best moments, which was that was quite an enjoyable book to write. But the new one is, as the title says, it's everything. It's hopefully everything. It's the vast kind of sweep of our history, but also the bad bits too, because I think the bad bits are really important. I think they form what Evertonian is. So I hope what the book does is give readers a taste of why Evertonians are the way we are, why our kind of outlook is the way it is. So it's not just about the great moments, the league titles, the FA Cups, the fantastic players, the great managers. You also got to have in there Benitez, you know, Lampard, the Everton that moment, many examples of misfortune that we've experienced, and those many times when the club on and off the pitch are completely ballsed up. So that's it's all in there, hopefully. And if you read it, you hopefully get a kind of a handle on not just our fantastic history, which, I mean, it is still great. We are still a massive club, but also why we are the way we are, really.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually, was obviously how you got the idea for the book. Like, you know, you've just gone through it. It's a little bit more irreverent than your other Everton books. I mean, there are odes to, you know, cult heroes like Dennis Dracolosi and the aforementioned Sweet Prince in the Ass. True or false questions, like, you know, did James Rodriguez actually ever play for Everton? Did you feel like we just needed something, you know, lighthearted, given the prevailing mood around the club?
I think it's an important part of being a fan. I think, you know, I think Evertonian's ability to laugh at ourselves is an important part of being a Blue. I mean, you certainly compared to Liverpool fans who have, you know, no sense of humour about their club at all. You know, they have Rizzler thin skins. But as Evertonians, we've got that kind of gallows humour. Maybe kind of, you know, we've been through so many, so much crap over years and such, you know, bad luck and terrible times. You know, and I say if it didn't laugh, you'd cry. And so I think it's, I wanted that to be a big part of the book, because it is, being Evertonian, it is funny. Lots of times it can be awful. And, you know, there are plenty of times when you wonder, you know, maybe I should have just taken a chance and on Father Christmas and and been a Red. But it's, you know, it's a club with a lot of kind of funny aspects about it, and it's I wanted to include even the bits that are crap in our history. There's still light amongst it. We do find that from these kind of dark moments. So it's like I said, I think it's, the idea was to give the full range of like what it is to be an Evertonian, and also it's quite like erratically structured. It doesn't go like from the start to the end, you know, chronological. It's you have like the 90, you know, the 66 cup final, and then you'll jump to something shit and then something good, because I think that's the nature of being a fan. It's not a, you know, it's not an upward slope. It's not easy. It's up and down. You go from, you know, like this season, you go from thinking everything's great, I'm doing well, and suddenly everything's gone to shit really quickly. So it's hopefully the book gives that impression that it's an up and down experience, especially being an Evertonian.
That's what I quite liked about it, actually, is like the spontaneity of it. Like, you have a little bit about Bob Latchford, then you're on about like, oh, true or false, and then you're on about, you know, like, say some damn awful times in Everton, which did maybe like, oh god, we were two up against Newcastle in the 94th minute, and you know what I mean, like moments like that. And it's the funny thing with all them, I find, is moments of Evertonians, you come out with that and you feel so damn low, and you just think like, oh god, I just can't be doing with this anymore. But then a week later, you're at home to Brighton again or something like that, and you just back to, and you're back with your mates, and you're back sort of enjoying it again. And that kind of, I'm not trying to sort of put words into your mouth, but Jim, it feels like that's what it's encapsulating, what it's all about, being an Evertonian, you know, just like it's seeing the bright side of it. And I enjoyed it. It's really well written.
No, cheers. Well, but that was hopefully that's what, you know, I want people to feel when they read it. You get that kind of roller coaster feeling of being not just a football fan, but being Evertonian. Whilst at the same time, you know, obviously I've missed bits. You can't include every single facet of the last, you know, 100 plus years. But I've hopefully got in all the important stuff in there that really matters. So, you know, it's not just a case of not just Phil, but like Mike Walker and Benitez. There's also some good stuff in there as well.
Is there any sense of regret that obviously with the timing of releasing, you potentially missed about three or four either very good or very bad chapters at the end of the book?
Yeah. Well, I can add. That's the nice thing. Yeah. I can add. But you're right. I published it just before the 10 points. It was taken off. I thought, you know, Jesus Christ. The biggest thing that's happened to us in, you know, the last 30 years. So it's, you're right. That's the weird thing about Everton at the moment. It's like, you know, when you look at our history, you know, things would happen, you know, you get like a few big things, maybe a decade. Whereas we're getting, at the moment, it's, you know, over the course of a season, we're up and down. And it seems to be, it's like a soap opera. It's like, it's ratcheting up all the time. And it's, I published it, as you said, within a month. There's potentially four or five more things you could include, which is incredible, really.
So that's the thing with any sort of fact-based book, isn't it? It's time-stamped from the moment you publish. You know what I mean? So it's just the nature of it, isn't it? So it doesn't dampen the book or anything like that whatsoever in any situation like that. So it is quite funny. It's just that Sod's Law thing, isn't it? Like, well, that's happened just after press publish, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
So when did you get the idea? How long did it take to write?
It took about 6 months to write. So I began working on it, I think, about a year ago, and I've just kind of been at it off and on since then. It took shape as I wrote it, to be honest. I had an idea of doing it because kind of, you know, just the big moments and fact-based. But as I wrote it and as you talk to other Evertonians about things, you just get more ideas and more kind of points of view. And I think, you know, a lot of the things I've put in there have been sourced from other Blues. So I put things out to mates or on Twitter. You say, like, who are the five people we hate the most? And then you get a load back from that. And you say, you know, and then from that, you have to divide it. So obviously there's mainly Liverpool players. So let's have five just Liverpool players. And who beyond that do we hate? You know, who are the referees we hate the most and why? Who are the worst players we've watched in the Premier League? Which again is, you know, it's very difficult to get a consensus on that because there have been so many. And then, you know, things like, you know, the Everton that moment, you know, what I've got 10 in there, but I could have had about 50, really. So it's whittling that down. But it's been a good process where you just talk to Evertonians and you get their point of view, and it's everyone's different, really. You know, the only thing that seems to unite people is the greatest game. That seems to be, for those who are around at the time, it's always Bayern. That's the one that always sticks out. Mm. It's not like capturing the league title or an FA Cup final. It's always Bayern. If you were there, you were around, and you got to it, people are like, it's, you know, definitely the greatest game. So that's a rare moment of consensus among the Evertonians, I think.
What format is the book available in?
So it's at the moment it's only through Amazon. It's paperback and Kindle. But I'm hopefully getting some copies at St Luke's as well. So people hopefully, I think I'm doing like a sign-in there before the Burnley game this season. So I'll leave some copies there. And so with people, if they want to come in and get a book on the way to the match, then they can.
Very nice. Just before we wrap up, two more questions for you fellas. I can't see us letting anyone leave unless it's a young player on loan, perhaps, as I think it would be suicidal. But do you think we'll sign anyone before the deadline?
Oh, man, it seems unlikely, doesn't it? I mean, you know, yeah. I think we need something. Obviously, the squad is threadbare. You need a few more bodies in there. We're only kind of a few injuries away from a crisis. So it's, you'd think we'd try and get somebody. But whether the club has the finances to do this, you know. Although, weirdly, Forrest have got two players. They have Forrest in trouble. Yeah. I'm just going out, and they seem to have adopted the kind of fuck it approach. We're just going to get what we can. So they're doing that. So, but Everton seem to be kind of toeing the line. So it's, I think it'd be a welcome surprise if you woke up next morning and we got somebody in last minute. But I mean, I think it seems really unlikely. I know that they're really playing it down, aren't they? They're saying it's going to be quiet, and you don't seem to be, you know, actively linked with anyone in particular. So it's, we clearly we're in desperate need of more bodies. But it's, I just think the way things are at the moment, it just seems to be really unlikely that we'll bring anyone in, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think anybody will be coming. I'm just hoping nobody leaves, really. I hope there's not some, like, you know, big bid for an honor or something like that. We can't afford to lose anybody there. Even, like, you know, Ben Godfrey, for example, has been linked. He really showed his worth last night. Fair play to him. I think we're going to need them all at some point. I don't know, mate. I think we've seen it, you know. I mean, to be fair, like, normally by now we've been linked to a couple of players, haven't we? And you think, oh, okay, you get into deadline day, you think, oh, something's going to happen, and then nothing does. And but this time, it's just been so quiet this winter. There's been no real sort of, like, you know, like, any real threads, really, has there, in terms of, oh, we're going to get this player, etc. So, no, I don't think anything will happen. I think it'll be a quiet day.
Agree. I don't really know what I can enhance that with, other than absolutely not. If we sign someone tomorrow, surely it means someone else has gone. And again, I can't really see that being allowed to happen unless, rather than fuck it, we've really fucked it, which we already sort of have in that position. That lack of sustainability from someone like Forrest does just show how bizarre this situation is that we're in, where other clubs continue to be linked with big names on big contracts, and we're in this position where we can't really act. And obviously some of that is the situation with the ownership as well. But really, if there's one bit of business we're going to get done this week, it's getting some, if not all, of those points back, isn't it? So away from that, I can't really see any big Everton news.
Yeah, I think the loan deals tend to be easier, it seems, to get over the line last minute. And that might be why, if and you, I've got to imagine that Kevin Thirlwall is just hammering as many sort of loan opportunities as he can, because I can't see us selling anyone, because the risk of someone coming in, that deal falling through, leaving us completely short with very key player. I mean, it's really, you're looking at Onana, Branthwaite, and potentially Godfrey as people who can bring money in, and all three of those players we're going to need. So you leaving yourself open to the risk of not being able to replace them, I think, would just be, as I said, suicidal. So hopefully they're looking at a loan option at this point. Probably not going to have a world beater, but just someone with a pulse at this point who knows where the goal is would help, you know, just because we are so short on numbers. But your point about the appeal, Adam, was actually was the focus of the second question. It doesn't look like we're going to find out for a couple of weeks, but are Everton going to get any points back in terms of this appeal? Would you think all, some, none?
Don't know, to be honest. I thought the league had gone hard, knowing that we'll appeal, and then, you know, make it like five, and then everyone's sort of, you know, it's a compromise. No one's that happy, but it's just, you know, they've looked like they can regulate, and we've gone, oh, okay, it's better than 10. But then, you know, when kind of you read the report and everything, you think Everton have got a good case to get them all back. There's certainly a case there. But it's like, it's not like you're appealing to a properly independent panel, are you, really? You still feel like the league are involved in this. And so even if you have got a good case and you present it well, if it's a kangaroo court, what difference does it make? So my optimism has dimmed as it's got closer. I think, and you can really see now that in a few weeks we'll find out that the league the panel, you know, I've just gone, no, sorry, it's going to stand. It's, you know, a few months ago, well, before Christmas, you're thinking, oh, you know, even if it's just five, that's okay. But right now, I want all 10 back, because it's, you know, our situation has deteriorated since then. And actually, you feel like if we don't get all 10 back, it's going to be a really, really difficult end to the season. I think it's, you know, because 10 immediately changes everything, doesn't it? We're back to mid-table. The pressure goes. They'll play without pressure. They'll probably win more games because of that. If those 10 remain taken off, then suddenly everything's tense. Everything's panicky. It brings an extra edge into games that shouldn't really be there. So it's you'd like to think that kind of sanity would prevail, and there is some room for compromise, and, you know, some get taken off, and the league still look like they can regulate and they can fend off the IREG and that kind of stuff. And Everton, they can point out, Everton haven't been run very well, so they, you know, maybe we deserve something. But it's, And I, at the moment, I'm really pessimistic. I think the league will want us to be punished. They want a kind of a, they want a scapegoat. They want a club they can hold up and say, look, we can regulate. And they really want to punish someone. I don't think, I mean, as long as it's not one of the big six, they don't really care. I think at the moment, Everton are a great example that they can show the government, they can show the kind of the future regulator, look what we did. We managed to punish this club like this. Look how strong we are. You know, if that, they won't want that watered down. So it's, yeah, I'd like all 10 back, but I don't see it.
When we got the 10-point deduction, I thought there's no way it's going to end up being 10 points. Was my initial thought. I thought, yeah, a bit like what Jim just said. They'll, you know, it's kind of done, and they'll Everton will appeal it. It'll be a compromise figuring that. But and again, I don't mean to sort of get my tin hat back on. I mean, but that. But just the way go back to the way we're getting officiated, what we're not getting in games, how we're being treated generally. It does worry me. Are they just going to double down on us, you know, and be like, nope, it's 10 points and that's it. I think Everton, you know, obviously, I'm no expert, obviously, but I think they do have a good case, and it looks like they have got the right lawyer in there to sort of, you know, to make the right noises about this. So, but the one thing I feel we got on our favour is if they do give us 10 points to this, blimey, have they set a precedent there? For like, if that's what it is for that size of breach, what the hell are they going to do to Forest, who are more in the, you know, who've got a larger over by more than we are with the FFP? What are they going to do to the others? You know, I mean, everyone's looking over the shoulders now. It's become so farcical. So if they start punishing one team, even if it's the team they thought, oh, we can do them, no one's going to care. I don't think they realise the bigger implication that this could have. And look at this transfer window throughout the whole league. It's never busy. Yeah, you know, January's never busy anymore. But it's just been, it's been, you know, nothing's happened. Everyone's just like, you know, you know, and I know the change of the rules again and all that. Like, but I just think leaving it at 10 points, it's the one thing I feel like we might just be in our favour. It's such a huge precedent to set. And if that's your margin of error, then bloody hell. How many teams are going to... What? It might just become so farcical over the next season or two, if that's what it is. And, you know, so that's something that might just be in our favour. But in any event, I just don't think we're going to get them all back. And that's the thing. So let's see. I was more optimistic, yeah, like Jim was saying. But... who knows? Maybe it surprises you. It's a shame we won't really know how it's gone or what's happened or have any real sort of insight. It's all going to just be, I don't know, we'll be enjoying your morning in a few weeks' time. And then
and all of a sudden, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Emergency podcast, fellas. So, yeah.
Sound the alarm. Yeah. I mean, it's sad, isn't it? Because if you'd have said to me a few years ago, oh, we're going to sign a guy called Lawrence Rabinovitz, I'd be quite excited. I'd be like, oh, he sounds good. Sounds like a, you know, football manager regen. And now it's just our lawyer. It's sad that we've had to spend so much of this season. I think that's where some of the apathy comes in with me over the last couple of months. But so much of what we love about the game, we're not really getting to do because we're either watching a game expecting a decision to go against us, or feeling hamstrung by this big decision that's gone against us, that's lurking in the background of every decision, every game, every sort of moment leading up to it as well. I think at this point, sadly, because of that, you take clarity over a reasonable decision. A reasonable decision is certainly not a 10-point deduction. It's certainly not a sporting sanction for a financial error that others have committed, you know, since the inception of the Premier League. And yeah, we're a part of that. And yeah, modern football is a bit of a farce, but we're not the first people to kind of play that game the wrong way. But as you mentioned, Jim, we are the right size club. We're just in that absolute sweet spot where hit us and, you know, others might, you know, see that that's a punishment if it's a crime. But you're also right, Paul. It's a hell of a bar to set. I don't know at this point. I would love to say that reason will prevail and that we'll look back on this as just a very strange asterisk in a couple of strange seasons, but I don't know. It might just be take your medicine, or it might be 6 points and that's still far too many and would probably still leave us looking nervously over our shoulders, particularly when Luton are picking up points again and we, you know, we're even having to talk about Luton. No offence, Luton, but it's very, very worrying. It's very, well, it's just consuming, isn't it? But at this point, I'd like an answer. And yeah, what I would say, and we've kind of already touched upon it with Deitch, is even though it's not always pretty, I do think he's the right person to steer us through this moment, whatever it might be. So let's hope that's the case. And yeah, let's hope Lawrence does his job.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we're not actually going up against a proper court, because then you'd be really confident that, you know, that a super silk in quotes would be able to get the job done. But as you said, Jim, I mean, if it is going to be, you know, a kangaroo court, I mean, the Premier League, or Richard Masters in his latest statement yesterday, or in that letter rather, back to the DCMS, you know, his assertion that everything is, you know, above board and it's a completely independent. I mean, I think that at least one of them has connections to the Premier League. The fellow who was on the part of the decision with West Ham and the Sheffield United case, you know, a decade ago, he was involved. So I just don't see how he can make the case that it was completely independent, because it wasn't. And so, you know, that's the concern, is we don't know who's obviously going to be on this new three-man appeal panel. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But on the one hand, I was, when it first happened, I thought there's no way that they'll allow, not allow, there's no way that we won't get some points back, just given the reaction from the wider game, politicians, you know. But the longer it goes on, the more I'm caught between the Premier League on one hand wanting to, as you know, as we've said, press home their credentials and not need regulation, and on the other hand, maybe showing a bit of sort of common sense in terms of the proportionality of the sanction, maybe that will help them in terms of public perception. Maybe the way that it seems to be drifting is that bill is going to get presented to Parliament regardless of what happens with Everson. And so it may just be academic, but if I had to guess, I'd say maybe we get 4 or 5 points back. That would be nice. I can't see us getting all 10. I really can't, just because it would go against, you know, the whole idea of regulating a club that's admitted to breaching, you know, the PSR. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But some points, any points would be back. I think that would just, it would provide a lift, you know, to the club, wouldn't it? And the fans, just to have something, even a small victory. Okay, well, thanks, fellas. Thanks to Jim for coming on. Best of luck with the book. Once again, it's available to buy now on Amazon, along with all of Jim's other books. We will either be back early next week to review the Tottenham game, or we might jump on for a spontaneous podcast if Everton surprised us all by signing someone before the deadline.
See you next week.
Either way, until next time, thanks so much for listening. Keep the faith and up the toffees.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.